Alison Krauss performed this song a couple of years ago on her number one country album, Paper Airplane, but Lay My Burden Down was written by Aoife O'Donovan, who's now given her own voice to her own song. It's the first track of her debut solo record, Fossils.
If I was cast out on the sea, would you come? Let me sink beneath the waves so blue.
And Aoife O'Donovan joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Any concern about leading off your debut CD with your own song, but already reasonably well known in another voice?
Well, certainly concern was there. The person who really encouraged me to go ahead and put that song first on the record was my producer, Tucker Martin. He felt that my version of the tune really set a nice tone for the record, and I kind of went with him on that one. I left it in his hands, and I'm happy that it leads off the record. It's a pretty different version than Allison's, and I think there's room for both.
If you can make it through the day, it's not that far. No, it's not that far.
My years as a band member in Crooked Still, mostly, but also with other side projects like Sometimes Why, etc., have definitely helped shape me as a musician and as a collaborator. And those are things that I kind of wouldn't trade for anything. The experience of going on the road with a band and not having the stress of kind of everything kind of falling on your shoulders. Those are things that are important.
Let's listen to something from the new album, and this is the song Fire Engine.
Down on the ground, put my pebbles in a mound. Gotta dig a little deeper to hide these jewels that I found from the fossils and the fables told to me by my neighbor. 3 blocks down, when you were able, make a sound.
This song is where we hear fossils. So should we know immediately why the whole album comes into shape with that, why it's called that?
I think that in that song, it's a little bit of a love song, but I'm talking about in that chorus, getting down on the ground, putting my pebbles in a mound, and sort of having to dig a little deeper to find the jewels, or to hide the jewels. That sort of changes from chorus to chorus. And that, to me, is a metaphor for kind of getting your ducks in a row, which I think does have a lot to do with putting this album out, mm-hmm. waiting for your ducks to be in a row. And among the fossils and the fables, both kind of, to me, very beautiful images of things old and sort of, but that can continue to be relevant. So some of these tunes on the album are older than others, and they're still relevant to me. There's still songs I love to sing, and that the same goes for kind of the songs that I grew up singing, old folk songs, the songs that I sing in Crooked Still. They're fossils in a certain way as well.
How did you come to grow up singing old folk songs?
My father is from Ireland. He mm-hmm. came to the U.S. in 1980 and met my mom and stayed. And he has a great love for folk music, as does my mother. So I was kind of constantly surrounded by Irish folk music specifically. He's got an Irish folk radio show. And through him and through my mom, I was also exposed to a lot of American folk music and ended up just really embracing it and going on to kind of study it in college. And here I am now.
Let's listen to a cut from this new CD that is not traditional Irish. This is a song called Beekeeper. Conscious effort to sort of mix things up, step it up here?
Not really. I think, you know, when I went to college at the New England Conservatory of Music, I was studying in a program called Contemporary Improvisation. It started out as being called the Third Stream Department, and somebody who was playing on my record called my music Third Stream Country, which I really liked. It sort of has the jazzy influence, but it also has a very sort of rooted Americana influence as well.
I have been, I confess, all week off and on rehearsing how to say your name. And Aoife I can manage if I don't look at how it's spelled,
which is
A-O-I-F-E.
Aoife is a super common name in Ireland.
Right.
And Aoife O'Donovan is also a very common name in Cork. So there are tons of Aoife O'Donovans in the town where my dad grew up. I think there are like about five that I've run into at different times in this tiny town of Clonakilty.
Now, your younger sister sings harmony vocals on this CD.
Are you going to try to say her name now?
You can tell I was avoiding it, couldn't you? It is spelled F-I-O-N-N-U-L-A.
U-A-L-A.
All right, I beg your pardon. Oh, now I know how to pronounce it.
I know, that extra A really gave it away.
Finula. Did you grow up singing together?
We did. She's 11 years younger than me. She's a college student up at McGill in Canada. And all four of us, I have two brothers in between who also sing. And we all grew up singing together. And Nula's singing is so beautiful, so pristine. And so exact, so flying her in to sing on the record was, you know, first and foremost a matter of sibling harmonies always sounding the best, but I knew it would cost me the least amount of money because she would nail it in one take.
Oh, I thought you meant just because you can always make a deal with your sister.
Well,
right?
That too.
Yeah. Wishing on a wishbone ain't wrong. Sucking on a peach stone to get strong and low. Are there connections between the your music and the Irish musical tradition?
I think there's a deep-seated way in which I approach music that's very rooted in the Irish tradition. I think I've got a great love for melody.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the old Irish ballads are, you know, some of the most beautiful melodies, the most haunting airs that you can imagine. And I think I try to incorporate that in my own music. I always start with melody kind of first and foremost when I'm working on a song. And lyrically as well, there are some images from the Irish folk tradition, but also from the American folk tradition, which, you know, kind of if you look back at it, they're very connected as well. And those images, Laying Your Burden Down, or mm-hmm. In Briar Rose, a song on the album, I kind of use a lot of folk images in that song as well. And those are things that I definitely draw from. Why you look so sad, I don't know. Did you pick your thumb, just skin your knee, running down the stairs looking for me. Everything's on fire, everyone's asleep. What do you, having grown up in a musical family and making this your life and livelihood now, what do you think music can do for people? I think music has the power to heal, of course. Music really has the power to make people feel things that I don't really think you can feel from anything else. I mean, of course, all art has that power in a certain way, but for me, specifically, music is just such a physical experience. When I hear something that really moves me, you can feel your body sort of tremble at that, and that's no small thing.
Let's describe this to our listeners. You're sitting here in our studio. And you have a guitar in your lap.
I do.
And a microphone set up and a headset on, which all of which suggest to me that you might do a song for us.
I'm thinking about it.
Can we persuade you? Tell us a little bit about it first, because you're going to play us out with a song.
So the summer of 2011, I think it was a very hot summer in New York. And I spent the 4th of July with some great friends of mine, and they were doing a pig roast in the backyard of our favorite bar, so we decided to skip the fireworks, which really upset my friend Betsy. And a couple days later, I was sitting in my apartment sweating, and I picked up the guitar, and this song just kind of came out. It's sort of a wistful love song and kind of about being lonely on the 4th of July, basically.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
This is
Red and White and Blue and Gold.
All right. We'll hear it right now. First, let me say thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Scott. I wanna wait for the fire to burn my eyes.
you sleep, there's a band on the boardwalk. You're tapping your feet. I'm too drunk to dance. Black and blue all on my face. I wanna fall.
Eva O'Donovan singing Red and White and Blue and Gold in her studio. Her debut solo album is called Fossils, and you can hear two more music performances recorded here in our studios at nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Come on, let's kiss in the July sun, beneath the July sky. I'm feeling like it when you pass me by. Red and white and blue and gold. I want to wait for the water to touch my toes. It's the 4th of July. I want to wait for the fire to burn my eyes.
Fifty-five boys were part of a bold experiment in the early 1960s. They were placed in an intensive summer school program, and if they finished, the headmasters of 16 prep schools agreed to enroll them, all tuition paid. The boys were all poor. Almost all of them were black. That experiment evolved into an institution that celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. It's called A Better Chance. The organization is funded by individuals, foundations, and corporations. From NPR's new Code Switch team reporting on race, ethnicity, and culture, Shireen Marisol Meraji has our profile.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, singer-songwriter Tracy Chapman, and Luis Uimias, the president of the Ford Foundation, are among the nearly 14,000 A Better Chance alumni. And soon, you can add these two names to that list.
My name is Frank Hernandez. I'm a senior here at Thatcher.
My name is Mahogany Monet, and I'm a junior at the Thatcher School.
Frank Hernandez and Mahogany Monet are A Better Chance scholars at a boarding school in idyllic Ojai, California. The campus sits on 425 acres, complete with citrus groves and more than 100 horses. Along with rigorous academic requirements, students have to care for and ride the horses.
I was super nervous for that, and I remember talking to a girl next to me. She was like, oh yeah, I've ridden before, and she gets on her horse, and she's doing like amazing things. I'm just like, oh my God, what am I doing?
Mahogany and Frank described their first few weeks at the Thatcher School as exciting and totally overwhelming.
The only thing that ever came close to it was Astro Camp in fifth grade, which we were gone for like 3 days maybe.
Frank grew up in a working-class Latino neighborhood in Santa Ana. His dad's a truck driver. His mom?
She is a factory worker. She assembles extension cords and things like that.
Mahogany's mom, a single parent, raised her in South Los Angeles.
And my mom's a high school English teacher, so she kind of knew the schooling system in L.A., and she was like, I don't really want my daughter to go to school in L.A., or at least not a public school.
Instead, she's at a boarding school just 90 minutes away, where a good number of her classmates are very well off. Mahogany's neighborhood public high school graduates less than half of its students, and most of the kids that go there are poor.
We're talking about families for whom independent boarding or day school would be completely out of their reach.
That's Sandra Timmons.
And I'm privileged to be the president of A Better Chance.
Timmons says since its inception, A Better Chance has been a talent scout for prep schools looking for diversity. In the 60s, a majority of the students were black and poor.
The original topic was poverty. You educate people to become leaders and to help raise these communities out of poverty in many ways.
Today, Timmons says, A Better Chance is about changing the face of leadership in the U.S. to better reflect its demographics. Latinos are a much bigger part of the program. So are Asians. Middle-class students have a shot, too. Hopefuls write essays, provide letters of recommendation, go through an intense interview process. And if they make it in, A Better Chance works to match them with its schools. It's competitive. Last year, less than a quarter of the 2,500 students who applied were placed.
What they're really looking for are students for whom education is a priority.
Derek Perry is the director of annual giving at Thatcher. He also went there as an A Better Chance scholar in the early 80s. He says, like Frank Hernandez and Mahogany Monet, he had to acclimate to boarding school.
My home, coming from a typical African American, was full of bluster and yelling and screaming. And that's not the norm in white dominant culture.
But Perry says he learned what he considers a valuable skill, one that helped him graduate from an Ivy League college and climb the economic ladder.
It's very important for talented students of color to come to a school like this to learn the language of the dominant culture. They tend, at a pace like that, to have conversations that are muted and rely on rhetoric, and to learn, A, that it wasn't threatening, and B, I could thrive in it, was a valuable tool for me when I went from Thatcher to Dartmouth.
And he died for Daisy, which is not surprising.
What do you mean that's not surprising?
Because his whole life has been revolved around her, so I think if he were to die a certain way...
Mahogany Monet is one of 14 students discussing the Great Gatsby in an AP English class at Thatcher. The students sit around a large oval table, and their teacher sits right alongside them. Mahogany says she loves her teachers and the small class sizes, but there have been times where she's felt very vulnerable.
For example, freshman year, we were reading Maya Angelou, and I was the only black student in my class, and I had particular feelings I had about it. But sometimes you couldn't always feel like you could express them because you feel like you were expected to talk for all black people. I am one person. I can't speak for everyone. I can only speak for my experiences and what I've gone through personally.
Mahogany is telling the story of being the only black student in a prep school class 50 years after the creation of A Better Chance. The program's leaders say they want to help make stories like that obsolete in boarding schools and boardrooms. Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
And the Thatcher student we met at the start of this story, Frank Hernandez, graduates today. This fall, he'll attend President Obama's alma mater, Occidental College in Southern California. Sometimes history gets revealed in small, nearly forgotten scraps. The Allied invasion of Normandy took place on this week in 1944. On the evening of June 5th, the largest armada in history began to churn through heavy swells in the English Channel, and pink-cheeked young paratroops prepared to board airplanes that would fly through heavy gales to drop them in the darkness on occupied France. The weather was so vicious, German generals were sure they could rule out any invasion, which convinced General Dwight Eisenhower, the supreme Allied commander, that he could no longer keep 160,000 soldiers, sailors, and flyers, American, British, and Canadian, bottled up in ships and bases. "I don't like it," he told his generals, "but we have to go." So Eisenhower paid his respects to U.S. and British paratroopers as they lined up to fly into battle that night. Their faces were smudged with ash, soot, and tea for camouflage. Their helmets sported twigs and leaves. It was a kind of dress-up that seemed to remind Ike, as he was known, how young were the men he was sending against a raging sea and scalding fire. He told his driver, Kay Summersby, "I hope to God I'm right." And that night, in a drafty cottage under the roar of wind and planes, Eisenhower penciled a note on a small pad in his tight, precise hand that he would need to deliver if the invasion went wrong. "Our landings in the Cherbourg-Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops," he wrote. "My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." It's telling to see today where Eisenhower made changes in his note. He crossed out this particular operation to write, "my decision to attack," which is emphatic and personal. And he drew a long, strong line under "mine alone." When you see those words and that thick line on the note today in the Eisenhower Library, you might feel some of the steel of a man who would so unflinchingly accept responsibility. Ike didn't try to camouflage failure in phrases like "mistakes were made," "our projections were not met," or "I will say nothing pending investigation." He wrote, "any blame or fault is mine alone." Dwight Eisenhower put the note into his wallet. The invasion succeeded, and although a lot of dying was ahead, his note never had to be used. But it revealed a character that was enduring. You're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Throughout the entertainment industry, you can find alumni of a tiny high school program who were building sets in Hollywood, mixing sound on Broadway, and performing on TV shows, including The Office. They're graduates of the Addison Repertory Theater, or ART. The program is a kind of incubator for actors and theater technicians in Middlebury, Vermont. Julie Burstein went to see what makes ART so effective.
When students at Addison Repertory Theater talk about the program, a common thread quickly emerges.
If I had been forced to be into the box that the administration of my ascending high school had wanted to put me in, I would not be a successful person. Absolutely, definitely not. No, no.
I don't think I would have graduated high school if I hadn't come to ART.
ART program director Steve Small knows how hard it can be to imagine a future when you struggle in high school. Small studied auto mechanics at the Hannaford Career Center, though it was called the VOC then, for vocational school. After graduation, he worked on cars and in his family's orchard. He spent time in the Army, and then he headed to the University of North Carolina School of the Arts to pursue his passion for acting. A visiting professor gave Small some advice.
And he said, you know what, Steve? He says, you're going to work your way into this business. And my initial internal response was, I don't want to work my way into the business. I want to be discovered. But he's absolutely right. I've been working my way through this business.
Steve Small crafted a successful career. He built sets on Broadway. He welded the chandelier for the movie Edward Scissorhands. He even acted in a few television shows. After moving back to Vermont, Small started the theater tech program at ART because he knew his students would be able to get jobs.
You're not always going to be the star on the stage. You're sometimes going to be painting sets or hacking into some wood and building a platform or something, or maybe running lights.
Megan Patton has been in ART since the middle of her sophomore year, when she played Wendy in Peter Pan. Students at ART spend 2 hours a day practicing theater crafts in the morning or acting in the afternoon. And academics are woven into everything. The students analyze the plays they perform and sometimes compose their bios in iambic pentameter. Just a few days before their final show this spring, in ART's Black Box Theater near the welding lab, students were still painting sets and flubbing their lines. As opening night loomed, stage manager Bowen Abbey stayed remarkably calm.
If I was a hot mess right now, then I feel like that would translate to the rest of the cast. And it's very important that I, you know, try to keep a calm, in control demeanor.
Bowen and five other students piled into a van last February to drive to New York City with Steve Small. They were headed for the Unifieds, where performing arts colleges from across the country audition regional high school talent. Small has a ritual to combat nerves. Every year, the night before the auditions, he and his students hike to the middle of the Brooklyn Bridge, where kids perform their monologues, accompanied by frigid gusts of wind and roaring traffic.
I say, accumulonimbus.
The next morning, Small works the hallways, getting kids into auditions without reservations, chatting up administrators, showing his students how to network. All six ART students received offers of admission to their top choice colleges.
We're looking to see if I get a walk-in.
This is where Cammie goes.
Okay, ART yes. Graduate Cammie Shishko just completed her freshman year at Cornish School of the Arts in Seattle. When she decided to enroll in ART in high school, her guidance counselor told her she wouldn't get into college if she studied theater.
He wanted me to take a bunch of AP classes and all this. He thought that I was not using my full potential, and I'm really glad I didn't listen to him.
Her first year at ART, Cammie created the costume for Peter Pan. Small says the costume nearly stopped the show because a thread caught in Peter's flying harness when he was fighting Captain Hook.
He's on a double harness and one released, so all of a sudden, instead of doing flip sideways, he starts spinning around by one pickup point. The rigging just went all the way up through the whole thing.
I felt horrible about it. And Candace was just like, meh, it's a learning experience. It happened. And she fixed it.
Candace Burkle was the co-founder of ART, an English teacher whose vibrant creative spirit infuses the program. Peter Pan was her last show. She died in 2011. Students tear up when they talk about her, and one, Chenoa Small, wore her teacher's dress to her audition for Luck. Chenoa is Steve Small's daughter, and studying with her father in ART was sometimes complicated, but acting offers a place to turn emotions into art. Chenoa chose to audition with this monologue from Brighton Beach Memoirs because it gave her a place for her grief after Candace Burkle died.
Then I found his coat in Mom's closet, and
I put my hand in the pocket and it had been emptied and dry cleaned and it felt cold. And that's when I knew he was dead.
In the fall, Chenoweth Small is headed to the theater program at Northern Illinois University, along with Megan Patton.
It's funny that the first show I did was Peter Pan, and it's about not wanting to grow up and stay a child forever. I was very young, and I feel like I'm coming out older and wiser, and I'm making the decision to grow up and to be something incredible, I hope.
In the black box of ART, young actors and technicians learn to create something out of nothing, to build entire worlds out of wood and fabric and words, to imagine themselves into the future. For NPR News, I'm Julie Burstein.
If you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Tess Vigeland. Comedian George Carlin liked to say that art doesn't have a finish line. Our next guests are the embodiment of that idea. Each is a superstar in his chosen field. Rock music legend, best-selling novelist, record producer. Art they could have been content to pursue to the grave. Instead, they went and wrote a musical together, 13 years in the making. Ghost Brothers of Darkland County was co-written and arranged by John Mellencamp, Stephen King, and T-Bone Burnett. It debuted a little over a year ago on a stage in Atlanta. This week, the trio released a special CD-DVD edition of the production, complete with libretto and a mini-documentary. And the cast here includes Elvis Costello, Sheryl Crow, Kris Kristofferson, and a host of other showbiz legends. The plot is based on something that happened in John Mellencamp's hometown. In fact, as he told me, right there on his land in Indiana, in a cabin he'd bought. The story dates from the late 1930s.
Two brothers were there late one night with a girl. They got into an argument. They had been drinking. One of the brothers hit the other brother in the head with a poker. You know, he didn't mean to kill him, but he did. And as the girl and the younger brother were driving into town, they lost control of the car on the gravel road, went into the lake, they drowned. So all three kids were killed that evening. And when they went back to get the boy who had been hit with the poker in the front yard, some animal had chewed his head off.
Only God knows where we've been.
Mellencamp recounted the chilling details to a friend of his, a talent agent.
This was about the time that Mamma Mia and all that stuff was happening on Broadway. And I was getting all these requests to do that with a bunch of my songs, and I wasn't particularly interested in it. And I told this guy this story, and he said, oh, that would make a great Broadway show. And I said, yeah, if you could get Stephen King to write it. He said, well, I'm Stephen King's agent.
Enter the King of Horror.
Hi, yeah, Steve King.
The two had never met before, and at first, King was a tough sell.
I've taken calls from Arnold Schwarzenegger, who wanted me to write the scariest devil worship movie ever made. And, you know, there was a call from David Bowie who wanted about the same thing. So what I'm trying to say is a lot of times very talented artists have very bad ideas.
But King invited Mellencamp to visit his home in Florida, where the rocker again shared the story of the three dead kids and the idea he had to bring it to the stage.
And I sat down with my wife, who is the smartest guy in the room at any time, and I said, what do you think? Because usually when I say that, she says, I don't think you should have anything to do with this. You got too much to do, blah, blah, blah. She said, he's like you. He thinks like you. He talks like you. I think you should do it.
Still, Mellencamp was realistic about the odds of a project like this getting off the ground. Both were busy with other things. And at the time, Stephen King was recouping from an accident that almost killed him. He'd been walking on the side of a road when a distracted driver struck him from behind.
He was on a cane, and I really kind of felt sorry for him. And
you still feel sorry for me, don't you, John?
Not as much as I did. Not as much as I did. I said, I don't mind waiting, Steve. You know, I'm in no big hurry for this. So, you know, when you get around to it, you get around to it. And literally within 10 days, I get like 65 pages of the synopsis where he had taken that little ghost story and made it into a Stephen King story.
You know what a loser is? Someone who can do in a game what he can't do in real life.
Tell him you can prove it.
And I'll prove it. You see that bowl of fruit?
Stop! This is crazy!
I will just put this apple on my head like this. Now, let's see how you do under pressure, Hawkeye. Shoot it off my head.
Go on and do it.
They traded songs and dialogue through email for more than 10 years, but eventually found themselves stuck. Their musical just didn't resemble anything fit for the stage. So, they brought their work in progress to the man who brought the music to the Coen Brothers movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And TV's Nashville, T-Bone Burnett.
The first thing I got was about 20 or 30 songs that were incredible songs. They had no destination in mind. They were just looking at what they had. There was this incredible wealth of material. It was this extraordinary story. And the thought of doing something like a radio play became very interesting.
Stephen King took the radio play idea and ran with it.
And my thought was, okay, we open this thing and we've got an old country DJ who's on the side and the spot comes up on him and he says, tragic news from Lake Belle Reve,
where it looks like a bad accident has occurred onto a double suicide.
And right away, you've got some of the background that you need. And we just kind of ran with that idea that we're looking at something that's going to be more of an auditory experience, or as much of an auditory experience as a visual one.
Let them crows pick your bones, let the wolves chew off your head. They'll not make you dig your own grave, they'll show that you was dead. Then I would be whistling all the way back home. Then I'd say a prayer, thank God that I won't have to see you no more.
I wonder if you would take me back to the premiere of the work, Atlanta, in April of last year, 2012. Mr. Mellencamp, what was your range of emotions on opening day, given that this was your baby from the start?
Well, you know, my whole goal, and I've told Steve this, is to just one day sit in the dark with Steve and watch this. That was it. I didn't care where it was at, what was going on. But to answer your question, I don't play well with the other kids. So my immediate reaction was I got pissed off and left. I think it was the only time I've ever raised my voice at Steve. Me, Steve, and T-Bone were sitting in there, and they were talking to the actors, and T-Bone sent me a text, John, you're scaring the horses.
You left the theater?
Yeah, I didn't leave the theater. I left Atlanta.
That was like 2 days before we opened, but he was back.
I came back, you know, but it was just I couldn't take it anymore because, you know, I'm used to saying, hey, put this guitar part on, and the guitar part goes on. Now, all of a sudden, I'm having to have conversations with people and saying, hey, this wardrobe is not working. Okay, we'll take care of it, and then nobody ever took care of it. Thank God T-Bone Burnett came down there to work with the band, because it was my band who I've worked with 1,000 times. But I was so put out with the sound engineer that I just couldn't deal with it anymore. I wanted to shoot myself, and the dialogue would start, and the volume would be down. Well, that just drove me nuts, because like the first
But it was a rehearsal. That's what it's for.
Hey,
he knows that now.
I know that now, but it still doesn't matter to me. And so it was just driving me lunatic. I mean,
I got to break in here. You know that saying about how some people do not suffer fools gladly? John doesn't suffer fools at all. And that's the absolute truth. I mean, I'm going to say flat out, John's the most talented person that I've ever worked with. This guy is so talented, he makes me look like a foothill compared to a mountain. You know, he just had it going on. And he wants things to be a certain way, and there's no slide zone with John. John wants to get it right. He wants it to be right. And when it's not, you know, I think in some ways he's like a mathematician or a chess prodigy who doesn't realize that other people don't get it the first time. The rehearsals for the show were ragged. There were problems there. And then opening night came, and we sat there in the dark at the back of the theater and watched the show and listened to the audience laugh the way that they're supposed to. And they were getting some of the lines, and they were gasping. And at the end of the first act, they stood and applauded. And I looked at John and said,
"We better leave
this
now."
I think what we said was, "We might as well die now."
Yeah.
Because it was really great. It was
somebody better shoot us because it's not going to get any better than this.
You know that voice you hear in your head?
That's John Mellencamp, Stephen King, and T-Bone Burnett. They are the creative team behind the musical Ghost Brothers of Darkland County, just out on CD and DVD. They're taking that show on the road this fall. If you'd like to hear a sample, go to our website. It's nprmusic.org.
I can get you to do anything I want, 'cause I'm a sexy one with all that good stuff.
And for Saturday, that's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Tess Vigeland. Check out our weekly podcast. Search for Weekends on All Things Considered on iTunes or on the NPR smartphone app. Click on Programs and scroll down. We're back on the radio tomorrow. Until then, thanks for listening and have a great night.
And when you feel like cheating on a lover, that's me.
The U.S. Department of Labor says 175,000 new jobs were created last month, but the unemployment rate went up 0.1%, and almost 20% of American workers are working only part-time, a historic high. Starting next year, businesses will be required to offer their full-time workers health coverage under the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, both by its supporters and opponents, but many business owners worry about how they'll pay for it. Clyde's Restaurant Group is a family-owned chain of 14 restaurants in the Washington, D.C. area. For half a century, Clyde's has been a meeting place for politicians and lobbyists, like those who passed this very legislation, to meet over drinks away from Capitol Hill. We visited the original Clyde's in Georgetown on Thursday night as the head chef prepped the waitstaff for dinner service.
Soup of the day. It's going to be a bacon corn chowder. We're still in peak season, about 3 weeks away from corn. But corn is still nice right now and still fresh.
Restaurants will face particular challenges. Most restaurant employees work for low wages supplemented by tips, leaving owners to pay a larger portion of the premiums to make health care affordable.
What we need to do now is we're going to take a field trip upstairs. We're going to talk about the insurance. You guys obviously know with 2014, the Obamacare, everybody has to have insurance by law, okay?
Today, Clyde's is giving the waitstaff some information about the new law. They walk upstairs to the front office to watch a video.
Okay, guys. All right. Where's Charles at? He's coming.
All right.
In this presentation, we will review relevant health care reform updates that will impact each of you in 2014, as well as review the four new CareFirst medical benefit plans.
All right, guys. I need you guys really to focus on this instead of eating. All right. I understand. You guys want to try the food? So this is what we're up here for. All right.
Now, most restaurants run on students who can use the money and people between jobs or those who need a second or third income to support their families. They may not want to pay more money for health care insurance. 75% of Clyde's staff is under the age of 26 and may not feel that they need coverage. Jeff Owens, who is Clyde's CFO, says he has to rethink his business plan.
It started out as a brainstorming exercise for us. We were able to sit in a room and without making any judgment, we would list out any ideas that was going to generate either cost savings or additional revenue. For example, someone might say, let's use paper napkins instead of cloth napkins, and so we put that on the list. And someone might say, let's reduce the portion size for our wild salmon. Instead of a 7-ounce portion, we're going to portion a 6-ounce portion, and we'll save some money there. The staffing, certainly that's part of the brainstorming. I mean, is there an opportunity to replace two shifts in the kitchen with one swing shift and save a few hours of payroll? We are all putting our heads together, and it's a real art to choose the ones that are going to be a good fit for us.
And then, of course, you can pass on cost to the customer, too.
And then that's right. So as our last item on the list is going to be how much of a price increase do we need to put onto our menu. It's a tricky thing because it's hard to forecast what the decrease in your traffic is going to be. It's interesting, someone had a creative idea is that we could start to charge our tipped employees for the credit card commission to collect the gratuities that the customers leave for them. The company spends probably $500,000 a year in credit card commissions for this tip income. You know, I'm not saying we're implementing all of these things, but it's a real exercise to come up with a plan.
Now, Mr. Owens, what do you say to those people who might be listening, who might be saying, but wait, your restaurant group, along with other restaurants, made a considerable amount of money for years by not covering employees. And now you're going to be part of a plan that will be covering your employees and bring greater stability into their lives.
Well, I think it goes back to just the classic economic model of a restaurant. I can't just simplify it and say, you know, if I gave everyone a 10 or a 12% pay cut, I would be able to pay for this new benefit. Or if I increased my menu prices by 6 or 7% across the board, I would be able to pay for this new benefit. It's really a matter of finding a way to be able to still operate under the new requirements.
May I ask if you considered increasing your prices and telling people why?
I've heard that idea from some other operators to just list an extra 5% surcharge and say this is for the healthcare benefit of all the employees. I don't suspect that we will end up going that route. You know, we're going to figure out a way to make it work, and it's going to be part of our business model.
So to put you on the spot even a little more, Mr. Owens, how do you feel about these changes?
Well, I mean, it's a challenge, but it's not a challenge that we're going to run away from. Certainly other companies are looking at paying fines or different ways to structure the organization to fall under the 50-employee rule. For the last 2 to 3 years, it's been the number one issue on our radar and in conversations with our board of directors is the biggest challenge that we're facing. So we're not trying to run away from it, but it's a frightening proposition.
Not to put words in your mouth, is it possible to make it work? You will have to reduce the number of people who hold jobs.
Well, I think one thing that we'll be able to do is take advantage of folks that have limited availability. In the past, those folks have been hard for us to work with because they are a challenge for scheduling and training and so on. But by us figuring out a way to work with these folks, that we will have more part-time employees.
So this is, for example, the school teacher that can work Tuesday and Thursday nights for a few hours.
That's exactly right. And you know, it's not that we're going to take a full-time employee and convert them to a part-time employee, but we do have a lot of turnover in this business. So by just being open to working with the more part-time employees, that'll be one of those items that I mentioned that would contribute to the cost of the benefit.
Jeff Owens of the Clyde's Restaurant Group in Washington, D.C. The new health care coverage regulations go into effect next year. And you're listening to NPR News.